This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in DC. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. I just have to say it's a beautiful fall day at last, and I'm so happy to be here talking about teaching food, and it just feels very fallish and fresh. So you've tuned into the fifth episode in Lunch Agenda's Teaching Food series. So far, we've talked about teaching food in school, teaching food for people on a tight budget, and last week about teaching food jobs, where we dug into culinary job training programs. For today's show, we're getting a little bit more theoretical. I have two experts in the studio with me, Christy McCarron, who's a program administrator at the YMCA, and Dr. Kofi Essel, who's a pediatrician and professor. These leaders have dedicated their careers to education and advocacy to tackle the health disparities we know are caused by a lack of consistent access to healthy food. I'm going to be asking Kofi and Christy about the theory of behavior change as it relates to teaching healthy eating, and about how doctors are intervening in the cycle of obesity to steer patients towards habits that will set them on a path towards health. But before I introduce them and get them talking, here's a little Kiko's food news to get you up to speed on the week in the food system. First headline of today. U.S. sales of processed cheese, including brands like Kraft Singles and Velveeta, are projected to drop 1.6% this year, which is the fourth straight year of declines. One by one, American restaurants and retailers are abandoning American cheese, and in many cases, replacing it with fancier cheeses. So Wendy's is offering Asiago, Cracker Barrel and Panera Bread have replaced American with a four cheese combo of Fontina, cheddar, Manteau, and smoked Gouda. So this might strike some listeners as good news, others as sacrilege, but it's just an interesting trend to watch. Second headline. The New York Times covered a story last week about a trailblazing German chef who quit the Berlin fine dining scene to tackle the challenge of cooking in a hospital. So beyond the food, of course, tasting better, the hospital's now sourcing locally grown organic vegetables, grass-fed beef, and catfish raised at an environmentally conscious aqua farm for its kitchen. Within 7 months, this hospital went from using three wholesalers to working with nine producers and six wholesalers. In keeping with industry standards, the kitchen spends the equivalent of about $5.50 US on food per person per day, which this chef says is doable since he's able to scale recipes to 500 portions and thereby make bigger buys. This is really inspiring to me, and I think I'm going to do a series on Lunch Agenda on institutional food procurement, because I see food sourcing by schools, by hospitals such as this, and by government institutions as maybe the biggest place to change our food system. I'm seeing my guests nodding. It seems that many of us have made significant shifts in our own consumption choices, so what I'm excited by is hearing more and more about how huge buyers are starting to make the shift to responsible and local food as well. So if you listeners, I'm asking you, if you know any hospitals or other institutions that are partnering with chefs or making big changes to their sourcing approach, I'd love to get their voices on the show a little bit down the line this year. And if not, maybe I'm going to have to ask Jack in our booth if he can help me get this German chef on Google telephone to call in, because I'd really like to hear people on the front lines of that work. Finally, before Kiko's food news ends for today, the DC food world is buzzing about an event that you don't want to miss, so I want to give a quick plug. On Tuesday, October 30th, Fresh Farm is having its annual feast, and for the first time, it's going to be right here at the Line Hotel, with food presented by Spike Gerdy, I think I'm saying that right, who's the godfather of local sourcing in this region, and I should add a fellow full-service radio host. Fresh Farm is the nonprofit responsible for 15 farmers markets across the DMV and offering in-school cooking and gardening at 13 schools through its amazing Food Prints program, which, if you want to learn more about how that works, I interviewed the program's director on the second episode of our current Teaching Food series. Along with Spike's Food from A Rake's Progress, DC Hot Chefs from Timber, Bad Saint, and Taleb Goat will all be here to help Fresh Farm raise as much as possible by wining and dining us. So head to freshfarm.org to nab a ticket, and I'll see you there. We're going to take a quick break, and when I come back on Lunch Agenda, I will be introducing Christy McCarron and Dr. Kofi Essel to talk about the theory of behavior change and clinical interventions in healthy food habits. So stay tuned.
And all the music on this program produced by Kiedo, K-I-E-D-O, on SoundCloud. Check it out for more.
This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in DC. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him. Welcome back, everyone. You've tuned into Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in DC. I'm your host, Kiko Bourne, and you're joining us for the fifth episode of our fall Teaching Food series. So I'm really excited now to introduce today's guests, who each work in DC at the intersection of food insecurity, obesity, and of course, education. Christy McCarron oversees all nutrition, culinary education, and anti-hunger programs for the YMCA of Metropolitan Washington. Christy also provides technical assistance and coaching to YMCA teaching kitchens and anti-hunger programs across the country. Plus, she's finishing up a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins University with a focus on food systems and public health. Welcome, Christy.
Thanks, Kiko.
And then on Christy's side, we're joined by Dr. Kofi Essel, who's a community pediatrician at Children's National Health System in Washington, D.C. Dr. Essel also serves as assistant professor of pediatrics, the director of the George Washington University School of Medicine's Community and Urban Health Scholarly Concentration, and as a contributor on the Clinical Public Health Leadership Team. Welcome, Kofi.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you, Christy, because you were the one who said, man, this series on teaching food, you need to talk about the theory of behavior change. So we're going to get to that. But first, Christy, how did you become a food teacher?
So my journey through food actually began in Washington State, and I was doing a volunteer program where I was a home cook at a house for folks with developmental delays. And I was also going to their doctor visits. And so I was very much in this intersection of cooking their food every day and then going to their doctor visits and recognizing that they were an elderly population, but they had a series of chronic diet-related diseases. And throughout the year, I was just able to incorporate healthier food that they weren't previously eating. And one by one, we would just go through these doctor visits, and they all just became healthier. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is it. And so I, instead of at the time going to grad school, went to culinary school, and then with the mission of using food as a tool for health. And then it's evolved ever since. And I started at the Y about 5.5 years ago after working briefly in schools. And that's where I am today.
Yeah. Amazing. And let's just get... Well, actually, before we talk about theory of behavior change, I want to make sure that our listeners today... know more about your program at the Y. So I bet many of the listeners didn't even know the YMCA had a robust food education program. I certainly didn't until I moved to DC. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the two teaching kitchens you've overseen in your role and the kind of classes that you offer there?
Sure. So we're the first Y in the country to have a kitchen just for education purposes, which means that a lot of our job has been figuring out the blueprint. And so our first Y, you know, much to the vision of our leadership before I was there, they put in a kitchen at YMCA Anthony Bowen at 14th and W about 5.5 years ago. And then, so we program there almost every day, whether that's we're bringing in our kids from our after-school program, we're doing programs for our seniors, and then all of our classes are open to members or anyone from the community. So we do a variety of recreational classes, whether that's, you know, making your own pasta, as well as behavior change classes, so getting folks healthier eating on a budget. And then about 3.5 years ago, we partnered with the Nationals Youth Baseball Academy, which is in the Fort DuPont community off of Minnesota Ave in Southeast. And so we program there. Our program over there looks very different. We're not in there every day, and it's very much geared towards behavior change and healthier eating and building a culture around healthy food, given that it serves a population or our, you know, our residents that have asked for more of those types of classes.
And so you did tell me that a pivot point in your food education career was when you encountered and adopted this theory of behavior change. What is it?
So there's a couple, and what we, you know, I think what, when we started working first with the Nats Baseball Academy, it allowed us to have a really good control experiment of this is what's worked in this setting at YMCA Anthony Bowen, and here's what's going to work well over here. We also received funding to focus very specifically on nutrition education and getting folks to eat healthier. And so our change in the program went from first a 6-week class to what's evolved into a 16-week class with monthly cooking, with monthly community dinners and multiple touch points, because we use more theories that encourage not just thinking about the skills and the knowledge that folks are learning, but what else they might need. Is that access? Is it maintaining a relationship with the instructor, which I think we've perhaps become obsessive over, is if I know that someone is trying to eat healthier, after they finish a 6-week class, what's going to happen at week 7? And more often than not, they're probably going to, you know, lose some of the skills or the knowledge that they've learned. And so, you know, and not to get too in the weeds, but that's the trans-theoretical model of behavior change, and it refers to all the phases of getting someone healthier. And what's most often missing in public health is that maintenance phase. So we really, really try to work hard on that, as well as combining it with food access and all the other barriers that someone might have to being healthy.
It's so interesting to hear this notion of the connection with the instructor being one of those key levers. Mm-hmm. And it brings me back actually to something that you said right in the beginning, that a first job you had was teaching food to seniors. Mm-hmm. And the ones that you got to go to the doctor with. Why did they even care what a young girl had to tell them about food? Seniors are so wise. They're set in their ways. You know, how did you offer them new information that they would trust?
Trust is the number one thing there. And we, honestly, in my office, I feel like that's all we talk about, because, you know, there's a lot of research on cooking classes right now and how effective they are. And we haven't really pulled out what about the cooking class is effective. And what more and more science is saying is that it's the interpersonal skills and the trust with the instructor and the participants. And so how we hire folks and how we put folks in the setting to teach the class, if they're creating a safe space for folks to be vulnerable about something that's incredibly personal, especially if they're really on a wellness journey, it's critical that the right person is, you know, role modeling that behavior, enthusiastic, clear in their instructions, and really just creating the safe space.
Right, right. And when you talk about maintenance, mm-hmm. the example that you gave me that was really concrete from Youth Baseball Academy was the community dinners mm-hmm. that you host mm-hmm. there. Can you share about that with the listeners?
Yeah, they're my favorite part of my job. Sometimes I can't believe I get paid to do it. But so our community dinners evolved because we had folks completing our class, and then you know, we knew that we needed to stay in touch with them because they might be trying to not drink soda or whatever we've touched about on in our classes, but they were no longer in our classes because they graduated. And so we also wanted to create an environment where the instructor could build a relationship with our participants that wasn't an educational environment. So just as a community building, relationship building experience. So we now host our first Friday community dinners. And therefore, anyone that's participated in the program, is currently in the program, or is interested. And it's just our way of honestly hanging out, of learning where folks are in what they're cooking at home and sharing recipes or just talking about how their families are doing. I mean, these are people that we've gotten really close with, or Tessa, the woman that really runs our program over there. She's so close with those families now. And so we're just touching back with them. And then in addition, you know, we try to be really intentional with building a participant design program. So every time that we get funds or we're changing something in our program, we use those community dinners as a really informal focus group and saying, hey, we're building a garden. How do you want it to look? Because we're not going to be using it. You guys are. Or we're adding another class. What do you guys want to learn? And so it's dictated our price of our CSA, what food we have in our CSA, how the garden will look. So that, you know, we have more buy-in, but it's more successful too.
Really cool. And I'm curious whether you could point out, because a lot of our listeners aren't in the DC area, whether there are any other food programs across the country, food education programs, I should say, that are deploying the theory of behavior change well.
I think so. I'm obviously mostly in conversation with WISE across the country that have built teaching kitchens. So I can speak better to that. And there's one in Medford, Oregon, a very tiny Y that is just doing amazing work and really implementing this long-term program that's doing a deeper dive into behavior change and working with the physician and the managed care organization.
Is that because they're a small town that you know, they're able to reach people more easily, or why is that?
I think, well, so what I just learned is that when Obama was putting in the ACA, he chose Oregon as a pilot state for their what's called CCOs, their community coordinated organization, something like that. But it's different from an MCO. And so they're able to work with places like the Y to really coordinate care between the program provider, the physician, and then the insurer. So it's just their state is doing amazing work. But I think in terms of nutrition education for behavior change, which is, and health outcomes, which is, you know, what most WISE are going towards, we're all really figuring it out. And I don't know, like, and not just in a WISE setting, no one has really perfected it. We all know that there's something there, but we're more likely to do these 6-week curriculums or whatever that we know we've heard of, but we're not sure that works long term, and so we're all figuring that out.
And I like that you actually raised the Oregon example and held that up, because it's a perfect transition to the last question I was going to ask you, which was, you mentioned actually last week at the DC Food Policy Council meeting that you partner with doctors to bring students into your classes. And you know, that's the last thing I'd like to hear you talk about before we move over to Kofi to talk about the experience in the doctor's office. How does that partnership work? How are students funneled into classes from their healthcare provider?
So we're figuring that out, truthfully. Kofi and I are just really good friends at this point, so I'm always like, hey, can you help me with this class?
Know anyone who wants to come to my class?
Yeah. And we're trying to figure out, how to organize that a bit better. At our site at the Nats, quite honestly, we currently don't need a referrals program because the classes just fill up really quickly, and that speaks to their community relationships at the Nats Academy. We don't have an organized referral system. I think that's where everyone in food is trying to go and to figure out how to coordinate that. You know, a relationship like the Y and Children's, our end goal is like better health outcomes. And so we know that they're so similar just by the institutions that we work at, and there's something there. And they all, you know, nutrition education and cooking education looks really different depending on the setting that you're in, but it just so happens that the Y and Children's have the same goal. So that's what we're working towards.
So Kofi, I'll ask you kind of for your side of that answer. But before I do, how did you decide to build a career that focuses on addressing health disparities and family obesity? Why did that become your focus?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think back into wanting to be a doctor all of my life, and I would see examples and knew this is something I wanted to do. But what kind of doctor exactly? I didn't really know what that would look like. I played sports all my life. I kind of thought the natural trajectory would be for me to go into sports medicine or orthopedics, doing something like that. I got into med school, and I started looking for summer opportunities. I started asking around for different surgery opportunities, but then I recognized I had this interest in nutrition and in advocacy, but doctors don't do that kind of work. That's not a thing that doctors do. And as we started exploring different opportunities, I came across a wonderful summer opportunity where I got to spend some phenomenal time with a mentor of mine named Dr. David Katz at Yale University, and I started seeing another element to my role as a clinician. In addition, I will say this, when I got to GW as well, I was really enamored by some of the work some of the community clinicians were doing that I saw around me. There was a professor by the name of Dr. Ronique Harris at the time who led a clinic at the ARC. And you know, it was great to see some of the work she was doing, the influence she had and the impact she was making in the community she was serving. She took me under her wing, and so many other advocates in the D.C. area took me under wing. Canary Gerardo, Ruth Perot, I can go on and on with names. But they took me under their wings. They taught me so much. They taught me to sit and listen to my community that I was serving before I jumped in and served. And I think that that's what transformed how I approached my interest and how I approached sort of what I could be doing in the next step of my career.
That's beautiful. I can picture you just kind of easing into this field that you just kind of followed your natural interests, and it needs you, because I think it's such a strong point. Doctors aren't supposed to be nutritionists, doctors aren't advocates, but we need them to be, and you're leading the way. For those listeners who don't know DC, what is the ARC? I just think it's important that's a great example of community partnership and advocacy, so just help them understand that quickly.
Sure. Sure. So the ARC is a multidisciplinary center in Southeast DC that offers so many different resources for families in that community. They have a Children's National Clinic, a mobile health clinic there. And actually one of the benefits there is we have sort of a mobile unit that travels throughout DC as well and provides care to different parts of the community as well. There's so many other different resources there. So Boys and Girls Club, there's other opportunities for mental health, there's a space for theater, and there's a school there. There's just so many things that families have been able to take advantage of, and I direct my families there all the time.
Great. And so how does the theory of behavior change show up in the doctor's office?
Yeah, great question. I agree with Christy. There's so many different theories. The question is, how do we use it? What I will tell you first and foremost is that when you look at behavior change, if you were to ask me how it works or does it work, I can give you three different answers on three different days depending on who I'm seeing. It never works, sometimes work, it always works. And what I mean by that is this, everybody's different. What influences people are different, but these tools that we have, these theories, are tools that we can use to really direct people in the right way so that they may likely make a behavioral change. So tools that we use in the clinical setting are things like motivational interviewing. Motivational interviewing is a tool that we get the motivation to occur from the inside of a person versus the external, right? So it's one thing to say, I'm proud of you, keep doing a great job, and being this extrinsic motivator or giving rewards or whatever it may be. But it's a whole nother thing to say, this is something that it's internally motivated me, and I'm going to make decisions because of something that I've found to be important. So how do you transition the motivation from me, the provider, to the individual? How do I empower this individual to make decisions that they can then run with? One of my mentors, Ruth Perot, always reminds me to never make the MD medical deity. Remember that our role is never to be sort of this, play the superiority complex. My role is to work alongside of my community members, my families, my patients, and help empower them to be able to make these decisions. So motivational interviewing is a key tool that we use. It can take a long time, but you want to use components of that in how you're interacting with your patients. So that's one tool. Christy mentioned the trans-theoretical model of change. I mean, that's something that you'll hear over and over again. And that's really looking at what stage of change your patient or your family's in. Of course, being a pediatrician, I don't only work with the child, I'm working with the families, multi-generational homes. I'm working with the mother, the father, the grandparent, the caretaker, whoever it may be. And I have to learn how to work with this adult and work with this child at the same time. And using these skills, using behavioral change theories, have been quite influential in that kind of work that I'm doing.
Wow. And you work as a pediatrician at Children's Health Center's Anacostia location, right? Yeah. So how does your work there compare to if you were stationed on the Michigan Ave Northwest location or in any other neighborhood in D.C.?
Sure. So something that I spend a lot of time talking about and doing work in is this concept of food insecurity. Food insecurity is something that your audience, I'm sure, is very familiar when all members in a household don't have consistent, reliable access to healthy and nutritious foods to live an active and healthy lifestyle. That is something that I consistently see is lacking, lack of food security. So a lot of my families are struggling with food insecurity. We know per the data, if you look at food insecurity, per the data is about 11% of households in D.C. When you look at national surveys are struggling with food insecurity. If you look more finely, there's a tool called the Food Hardship Tool. It's a one-question tool, but it asks a lot more people in the communities what's going on. And you can see families with children in these households, there's about 23.3%, almost 25% of households, one in four families with children are struggling with food hardship of some sort. You're going to see these food hardships in some of these more marginalized communities. One in particular is communities that I serve in as well at the Big Chair. This is a big thing that we see all the time with food insecurity. So as a result of me understanding that my families are struggling with food insecurity, it has to change how I approach my families, right? A level of empathy has to change. Being able to understand or better understand the context in which they're coming from, and that I can't just give a blanket solution to sort of addressing obesity or chronic disease or accessing foods. So I think that that's always in the back of my mind when I think about how do I care for my families, understanding that food insecurity is such a big issue. And let me add on top of that, food insecurity is a toxic stress. Okay, it's something that my families are dealing with that reduces their cognitive bandwidth, their ability to focus on so many other things. So as a result of that, I think about these other toxic stresses that my families are influenced by, and I take that into account when I'm working alongside of them. I think that's critically important.
So speaking of the food hardship tool, it's reminding me of a legislation or announcement, or I don't know what it would be considered, that happened 3 years ago when I was still working at the Capital Area Food Bank. And we heard the news that the American Academy of Pediatrics had made a recommendation, a formal recommendation, that pediatricians screen every child for food insecurity. And, you know, that was great news to us because we obviously were focused on this link between lack of access and diet-related disease. And I just wonder whether that type of pronouncement is making a difference. You know, what does the screening look like that you think most doctors are doing either in an environment where you work or in any other neighborhood? And do you think that type of announcement has made a difference in the clinical care families are getting?
I can talk about this forever, but I'll shorten my answer. So what I will say is that when I've done surveys and looked at provider practices around the country and locally, what are providers doing around food insecurity screening? Before this policy statement, you saw that providers were asking about it, but they oftentimes were waiting for some sort of clinical sign, some sort of laboratory sign, anemia, weight loss. These are signs that constantly would get providers say, hey, what's going on? Let me ask about some sort of hunger or something going on in the home. But the reality is food insecurity is often described as being invisible. We cannot consistently rely on laboratory, clinical, anthropometric weight loss, weight gain, these signs to be able to determine if a family is struggling with food insecurity or not. What this policy statement did was bring awareness to the issue of food insecurity. It made us all aware that this is going on. Our families that we're seeing each and every day, some of them are struggling with food insecurity and don't know where to turn. So it brought an awareness and I think is critically important. Now, what are we doing as a result of that? So to give us a tool to assess food insecurity and not be able to provide families with anything, that would be a hardship that we would recommend not doing. In fact, it's going to frustrate providers. They're not going to do it. And also, it's going to frustrate families. You've asked me these vulnerable questions, these risky questions. And what now? You've asked me to put myself out there. Then what? So what I think has been important is that with this tool, the policy statement, in 2017, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Food Research and Action Center came together and created a toolkit. This toolkit was disseminated all around the country. This toolkit gave us some more tools, for lack of a better word, on how to really implement this in the clinical setting. So how do you screen and then intervene? We screen with what we call the hunger vital sign. The first two questions in the gold standard questionnaire that's asked all around the country. Those two questions have great sensitivity and specificity. Basically, can identify families well who are struggling or at risk for struggling with food insecurity. At that point, we have to then figure out, we find these families, what do we do as a result of that? And we have a list of different things that we've been able to provide our families, from emergency resources to more long-term resources around federal nutrition programs, to getting them connected to community programs. But of course, we need to understand that food insecurity often waxes and wanes. It's not necessarily chronic. So these are things that we need to always have in place for our families. Families have told us that they enjoy that we now are open to the idea that something else is going on in their home, but they do want us to understand that it's a risky question. I'll say one more thing. Families oftentimes are concerned that if you ask this question and they answer the question, they may be considered neglectful of their children, right? If I say that I'm not able to provide my child or my family with this food, what are you then going to do? So we have to figure out ways to reduce the risk. And by doing that, we've provided it through laminated documents, kiosks. We've done a lot of different ways and really provided the families a safety net to say, hey, guys, we are here to provide for you all. We're here to work with you all. We're not here to sort of penalize you. So I think that that's an important piece, really providing that safe haven for families.
Yeah, just like you said that you could talk about this forever, I have 50 questions for you about what you just said.
Please.
The one I will ask, though, is, So based on their answer, you go through this, you have a list of different ways to point them from there, from the conversation. What do you need from the government, from community support perspective? What do you need to help them more? Mm-hmm. Probably money is going to be the answer, but what would you use that money for? If so, what is the next step of making that connection more smooth and more likely that they'll be able to take that step?
Poverty does influence food insecurity, right? Your food security is often influenced by how much income you have. Yes, if you're in the poverty, you're more likely to be food insecure. If you're near poverty or low income, you're more likely to be food insecure. But we do see a large number of those who are not in poverty who also experience food insecurity. So money, changing the system, huge, huge. What can we do right now? So what I would say is, from the clinical setting, we often don't have that loop around, the ability to have sort of that warm handoff, right? So we have all of these different organizations, the food pantries, other emergency food resources. They're doing phenomenal work. But what we would love to do is figure out, how do we sort of have this case management, the loop around to say, hey, we've provided our families with this great resource. They then were able to go here, here, here. It met a need. And then we were able to recognize that this is something that was important or valuable for that family. You know, as a pediatrician, I get to see my families often, very frequently, especially within the first 3 to 5 years of life. Phenomenal. But after that, it's yearly. So I might not get the opportunity to check in as much. So having sort of more loop around or wraparound services, I think would be a valuable resource for us. And of course, that's going to require money to be able to do that.
And I see Christy's nodding in agreement. And would you add anything?
We were just talking recently this week about that warm handoff and how important that is. Because I think a place like the Y or these community-based organizations that are so rooted in a community can do a lot of those wraparound services. They just need, just like Kofi said, the warm handoff. So it's not just, here's a flyer, go to this class, but it's like, I know this person, she's going to call you, she's from the Y, and here's what we can do once that happens. And then it's just a snowball effect from there, because then we can wrap them into our system and then continue that cycle of a wraparound service.
But so maybe I don't understand the scope of the Y, but does the Y have case managers or social workers that would actually, like, you know, hold themselves responsible for guiding individuals or families?
That's a really good question. So I'll say every association operates really differently, and every program within each association has different ways of handling whatever that program's goals are. So for instance, we have a youth and family services program that's out in Silver Spring area that works with a lot of migrant communities for a lot more of that case management to provide social services. For my work in terms of food education and food access, we don't have that done yet. I think that quite often it ends up being the instructor who has the consistent communication. She's also just really good at her job, right? So she can case manage. But that's the model that we know we need to get to.
That makes sense.
I can add one more thing.
Sure.
So it's capacity, right?
Yeah.
We have social work. Children's National, we're honored. We have social workers. We're a medical home for our patients and families. But because we have such high rates of food insecurity, right? So the capacity is overwhelmed. So exactly. So those are things that we have to think about, especially with the population that we serve.
Right. And I'll also add to that. I think that where there's a place for where a physician can have the physician's relationship is going to look really different from the culinary instructor's relationship, because there's like, it's just a softer environment, right? And so, there's benefits to having both, and both of those are gonna, the individual or the participant is gonna adhere to the instructor differently than they might the physician. And so there's benefits to having both of those relationships, and perhaps the case manager not being in a clinical setting for, you know, all of that and all the behavior change.
So, Kofi, the last thing that I want to ask you, because doctors are probably, you know, the only kind of guest I have that could tell me this, is what are the, you know, you talked about, clinical indicators or like hard data that reveal things. And you talked about how that's not, doctors shouldn't rely on those to determine whether they should talk to a family about food hardship. What clinical data is worth measuring if you know, for all the nonprofits that are doing healthy food interventions, for, you know, programs that are going into schools and providing food and everything else? You know, I know that a lot of nonprofits are trying to do this in different ways. Brighter Bites, based out of Texas, has, you know, gotten a body of information measured before and after. Joyful Food Markets, run by the Capillary Food Bank and Martha's Tables, trying to measure what a family, a family's food environment before and after. But because food is such a long-term prevention intervention, you know, because the effect of what we eat maybe can't be measured for 20 years, what is being measured? What is the medical community relying on to measure the efficacy of food intervention?
What is the medical community relying on? I think that's a slight, I won't.
Or get reword into, my question.
No, it's good. I think, put it like this. The way I look at this is you have subjective and objective measures. The better measures are going to be your objective measures. The issue is, oftentimes we rely on these very subjective measures. And so you're relying on memory, you're relying on social desirability bias, is what is the way I'll answer that. So basically, what do people assume you want to hear from them? I mean, there's so many other influencers that come into this. So when you, the closer you get to more objective measures, the better. Physical activity, healthy eating, all these measures are going to be better that way. Some things that I would say subjective measures that are very valuable is understanding the experience, the lived experiences of your families, patients, clients, whatever, however you want to call them. How do you do that? Qualitative assessments are rich. Individual interviews, focus groups, really getting an opportunity to dig deeper into what the why people do and act and how helpful some resources or experiences have been, I think are critical. Moving past that, you have your, of course, your 24-hour food recalls and those kind of things, which NHANES does, which is, NHANES is sort of the national gold standard for looking at some of these measures. But you can look at 24-hour food recalls and non-consecutive days to kind of figure out, hey, what are people eating in the last 24 hours? Has there been any change in diet? You can ask questions about fruit and vegetable intake. And again, those are some more subjective measures. The more objective, you're going to be doing biomarkers and things, right? You're looking at the blood, you're looking at serum, you're looking at changes, anemia, you're looking at what's happening with certain things like blood pressure, you're looking at what's happening with certain things like what we call hemoglobin A1C, diabetes measures. We're looking at some of these other markers, which food influences health.
Right.
Right. So the assumption is that by changing food intake, by changing these things, you'll have these measures that change at the end of the day. However, these are more long-term measures, right? Let's understand that as well. These are more long-term measures. There's some other things, knowledge, attitudes, even some behavioral changes that need to happen before we'll see these endpoints change. And I think that we need to also be clear on what we're measuring and what our goal is when we go into some of these interventions, because sometimes in a 3-week, 6-week program, we can't expect to transform the blood pressure or transform the hemoglobin A1C or some of these other more hard measures so quickly. Behavioral change takes time. Knowledge by itself, charisma by itself, these things are not what transforms people's lives by themselves. It requires walking alongside, empowering people. It requires a variety of other things have to come into place to help people as they change and transform their lives and maintain it as well.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I think that, and we were talking about this last week at the Food Policy Council, and I said this earlier, there's so many different types of nutrition education and cooking education, but and each environment is going to dictate its goals, right? So some, you know, a demo might be good because if it's in the grocery store or if it's at a farmer's market and someone's never had squash before, that's a perfect way to get them to purchase the squash. But to your point of, you know, what we're measuring, that's the tricky part with these nutrition education programs that so many people are working on, is that we've proven their effectiveness for an increased knowledge about nutrition, and we've proven that they might feel more comfortable in the kitchen. But what happens long term? What are those biomarkers that Kofi was just talking about? We just started a study, and it'll be 3 years to prove whether or not we're doing anything. And that's fruit and veggie intake, their cooking confidence, and then the food security because of our program. And we're doing a control experiment, so we're really excited to see what happens from that. And but that's the big thing right now. Nutrition education is like, what? Okay, we got this 6-week program and someone knows how to use a knife, but what does that mean next month or next year?
Yeah.
And the long-term change is ideally they're having a healthier BMI or, you know, they're less blood sugar, et cetera, that Kofi can speak more to.
And also generalizability, right? Like,
yeah.
Can I say that this population that I serve, this small group, can then generalize to everyone else? The reality is you can't say that. And we've seen that time and time again. A lot of the populations that have been served by some of the programs, higher income, different race, different gender, whatever it may be. And what happens is when they take that program and work with a more marginalized community, doesn't work. Attrition's too high. Retention is low. There's just so many other influences that didn't take into account. So you can't just generalize a program to anybody else you serve. You have to figure out how do you work with the communities that you're working with. And it has to be dynamic, as Christy has mentioned. How having that feedback from the populations you're working with right then and there. I think that's going to be the customization of the program.
Absolutely.
I think is going to be critically important as well.
Absolutely.
So speaking of approaches that are applicable nationally, I want to quickly, before we get to your action items, touch on the capstone project that Christy's working on for her public health master's. It's a training kitchen program manual And I got a sneak preview a few weeks ago. And I just wanted you to have a moment, Christy, to explain what the document is and where listeners will be able to find it if they're looking for a super researched guide that draws on this theory and the knowledge that you've gleaned from the whole network of WISE and all of your other learning once it's done.
Thanks for giving me the shout out. So
that's why you're here.
Yeah. So I guess the background of this is that for the past 8 months or so, I've been working with WISE across the country that have teaching kitchens. And honestly, we just needed a space to be like, what are you doing? And what curriculums are you using? And whatever. Because traditionally, the Y, we all share resources across the country. But because kitchens are so new, we haven't been doing that. And what we learned is that... yeah, we have a lot of growing to do, and we could do this. I think WISE put so much money and time and resources and into making their teaching kitchen. And as a nonprofit, you know, we don't have money or time to lose. And we're not necessarily meeting the goal of decreasing diet-related diseases because there's so many nuances and there's so much work to be done in nutrition education in general. And recognizing that we can implement these curriculums, but perhaps we just all need a bit more guidance of how those curriculums are implemented and what are the other factors that your community is facing that's gonna that's too much of a barrier for them to eat healthier that your curriculum doesn't even work. So yeah, for my capstone for Hopkins, I'm finishing this big manual that really forces the reader to think about the community that they're serving, all the other barriers that might come in the way, curriculums that we'd recommend, and other pieces of the behavior change journey that are critical to think about in order to see success. And so, you know, I talk a lot about the demos versus the classes, and as a rooted space, we really try hard to get folks doing these long series, long classes to actually see these long-term changes. So that will be out, or I will have it submitted around Thanksgiving, and then I'm working with folks from Hopkins and then a few other doctors to see what to do with it, because right now I'm not really sure. And of course with YUSA, I know it's a resource that's needed for WISE, but I don't know how that's going to be released to the public yet, and I'm still figuring that out.
Okay. Well, I was planning to share your social media handle at Christy McCarron, and that's KristyMcCarron. So hopefully you'll at least maybe, if it's available, you'll post it.
For sure.
And for listeners who want to follow Kofi, just while I'm on that topic, he is focused on Twitter, not Instagram, and he's at Dr. Kofi Essel, E-S-S-E-L, in all his spare time when he's not helping families. I'm sure he's tweeting up a storm. He is, though. I actually visited, and you're pretty active. But quickly before action items, I noticed, because I got this insider peek at the document, that Kofi, you had commented that you want to make sure that the guide includes info about obesity stigma and person first language. I was so intrigued. Quickly, what are you referring to there?
Oh, wow. We can talk about that all day. Yeah, so individuals with obesity are highly stigmatized in every area of culture, every area of society, even in medicine, right? Even us physicians have stigma towards individuals who have obesity, right? It's all about figuring out how do we transition the language? That's just part of it. Transition the language instead of identifying a person who quote unquote is obese, you say they have obesity. So you put the person before the disease. So the person has the disease, the person is not the disease, right? So all the judgment, the stigma, the bias that goes along with that disease, you're not then overlaying on that person, right? So understanding that, I think, is critically important, especially for clinicians, because that taints the way we care for our patients who have obesity, right? So I think that is really important. It's something that even community leaders need to understand as well, so that they care for their patients in a consistent manner as we're caring for our patients. And if we can get that across the board, that creates a safe haven for our families so they can come back and receive this maintenance, this action, this care that we're trying to provide across the board. We keep using scare tactics to try to influence our families, right? We're using the word fat. We're using the word chubby and all these words like, oh, it's going to fix things, or because of our own discomfort with the topic. But the reality is those words are highly inflammatory. They're not transforming. harming. They're only stigmatizing people. And I am a big proponent of getting outside of that language so we can really empower our families, especially those who have obesity or who have overweight.
And this conversation is actually very reminiscent of you know, conversations we had at the food bank. It's not a hungry person or a food insecure person. It's a family struggling or experiencing food insecurity at that time. It doesn't define them. So that's really resonant. Thanks for the clarification. So action item time. Who would like to share first one thing that our listeners from wherever they sit can do to help improve our food system? Kofi?
I can start. Diversify your table. Bringing children, different ages, race, gender to your table, income levels.
That's really good. Mine actually comes from Mark Bittman, and I just love this tip. I've thought about it for years. He recommends having 5 dishes. Mine's obviously geared towards education and cooking. Having 5 dishes that you know really well, be able to repeat them at any time, and then gradually add in things, different components to those dishes. And I think that lends more to intuitive cooking and confidence in the kitchen.
I love it, especially because Mark Bittman is going to be the last guest in the series.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's a good teaser. I'll ask him about that.
Yeah.
I'll tell him you mentioned. Thank you very much. So I am just blown away. I've taken more notes from this conversation than I can remember. And, you know, I'm just so inspired by the partnership that you two have. And I hope that it inspires my listeners also to, you know, be thinking that the relationships that we have with students that we're teaching need to be endured in order for habits to stick. And, you know, this notion of an MD not being a medical deity, you know, is really resonates with me too. I get nervous when I go into the doctor's office about sharing the truth about various elements of my life or my daughter's life. And this talk of toxic stress, I want to thank you both for sharing, and hopefully I can be part of your work and making it spread in any way I can. So for the listeners, I'm signing off. This has been a conversation with Christy McCarron and Dr. Kofi Essel. Thanks for joining Lunch Agenda today for the 5th episode in the Teaching Food series. And next week we'll take it back to an area of teaching food. I'm going to be talking to a couple food growing educators about how in the world people learn to grow food, whether they're in the rural area or the city. So I hope you learned from this academic and theoretical conversation, and I'll see you next week at 4 on Tuesday. Have a great day, everybody.